KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Yeah, obviously, you hate to see an NBA city leave any city in America, but you know, Seattle is definitely a city that deserves to have a team.
You know, many of the safeguards people are asking for, really demanding, they're really common sense demands. But of course, common sense is very uncommon.
We have always understood that when times change, so must we. That fidelity to our founding principles requires new responses to new challenges. That preserving our individual freedoms ultimately requires collective action.
Today on the program, we'll look back on President Obama's inauguration inside our chat room. At the end of the program, we're going to be joined by John Roderick, the songwriter, Lindy West, the local writer as well, and because we're also going to talk about the Sonics, Jason Reed, the director of Sonics Gate. You heard Ray Allen there talking about the Sonics. And in the middle, you heard Imam Rahman Joseph. We're going to talk about Imam Jamal, rather. Sorry, I added names. We're going to talk about violence in the culture. He's one of the interfaith amigos. Lots coming up today, but we start with the announcement about the Sonics and what that means. Looks like the Seattle SuperSonics, the NBA team, returning to Seattle. Yesterday came the announcement that Chris Hansen's investment group has a deal to buy a controlling interest in the Sacramento Kings from the Maloof family. The deal values the franchise at $525 million. Hansen's 65% will cost the investors about $340 million. The deal needs formal approval from the NBA's Board of Governors. That'll take place in April when they meet, apparently. Andrew Zimblist is a sports economist with Smith College. He covers these issues and the business of sports. Sacramento Mayor Kevin Johnson says he's hopeful he can keep the team in town, that he can put together a deal, and whether they have a shot. He even tweeted, keep getting asked, do we still have a shot? You better believe it. So I asked Andrew Zimblist, is there any hope for King fans?
Yeah, look, it's never going to be in David Stern's interest or the next commissioner's interest to treat existing host cities cavalierly. Whatever the inadequacies are of Sacramento or their willingness to build a new arena or their corporate base or their population, whatever they are, you don't want to treat them as though they didn't deserve to be NBA hosts. You have to treat them in a respectful way and express gratitude. And you have to, you know, show some sensitivity to the fact that this fan base, which to varying degrees has been involved with the team for a long time and provided subsidies for the team for a long time, that the fan base is going to be emotionally impacted by the team leaving, and you want to be sensitive to that. So I think that David Stern is simply playing that out. If new owners magically appear for the Sacramento Kings in the next week or two, then perhaps that would thwart a move to Seattle, but it doesn't seem at all likely at this point.
You know, the sale right now valued at $525 million, it says, and Hansen's paying $340 million for a 65%.
Right.
It's the second most ever paid for an NBA team. What, 2010, the Ted Leonsis paid 56% of the Washington Wizards, mm-hmm, Verizon Center, $551 million. What about these valuations? Where are they coming from?
Well, it's high. There's no question that the number is high. And by the way, you know, for all of these numbers that have been put out in the press, the devil is always in the details, and we don't know what's included in that $525 million. For instance, one article that I read said that it included the relocation fee, which will have to be paid to the NBA. Now, you know, how do they know what the relocation fee is? The NBA hasn't even approved the move yet, and they will no doubt charge a relocation fee to Mr. Hansen. All the leagues do that, because if Mr. Hansen is moving the team from an inferior location to a superior location, and he's buying the team from the Maloofs who have it in an inferior location, then he's raising the value, the asset value of the franchise. And the NBA, as do all the other leagues, view those cities that do not currently have a team as assets that they get to dispense with and to sell. So they're going to charge a relocation fee. Now, does that $525 million somehow include an estimated relocation fee? We don't know. If it doesn't, I'll tell you that it's a high number. You know, usually in the way one does franchise valuations in the different team sports in the United States is you use a multiple of the revenue that the team generates. And on that basis, the Sacramento Kings have been generating somewhere in the neighborhood, I believe, of $110 million a year. And the revenue, typical revenue multiple for an average team in the NBA is about 3. Now, that would put the franchise value below $350 million. So where they come up with $520 million or $525 is a curiosity. Now, yes, it's going to be worth more in Seattle, especially in a new arena, than it would be worth in Sacramento. And possibly also there's a relocation fee attached to it. But until we have those details, it's hard to assess and evaluate that sum, other than to say that it looks like a high number.
So as a sports economist, how are you assessing this, increasing valuation of these teams? Are they bringing returns back? Are the smaller teams, are the Wizards bringing the returns back?
Well, most of the teams today in the NBA are making money. The new collective bargaining agreement that took effect last year did bring down the players' share in gross revenues substantially by several percentage points. And there are two or three, maybe four teams sort of at the bottom of the ladder that have been losing money in the NBA and still are losing money. But the rest of the teams are doing quite well. And the television market has been robust. So television revenues, both locally and nationally, have been going up rather rapidly. And all of those things are supporting franchise values. And most owners are not only making annual profits, but when they go to sell the team, at least in this environment, they'll experience a nice capital gain.
Andrew Zimbalist is Robert A. Woods Professor of Economics at Smith College. He's a sports economist at the college. You know, I've read that part of Chris Hansen's expectation or ownership in the team will be through those TV franchise dollars. That's where a lot of his investments have looked to be heading. Is that why the team might have more value here? Is Seattle a bigger market than Sacramento?
The television market in Seattle is about 350,000 more households than in Sacramento, and it's also a richer market with a deeper corporate base. I think, you know, those provide opportunities not only for higher television revenue, but for more premium seating sales and more. If you sell more premium seats, it means you have a richer clientele at the arena. And if you have a richer clientele at the arena, then the advertising or the signage is worth more. The corporate sponsorships are worth more. And one thing leads to another. It's altogether a more attractive situation.
Now, the deal does depend on league approval. Some people are calling it a formality when they meet with the Board of Governors in April. But other deals have fallen apart, right? In 1994, the NBA rejected the Minnesota Timberwolves' move to New Orleans. Of course, they accepted the move of the Sonics down to Oklahoma City.
Yes.
What might they be looking for in this deal?
Well, you know, look, first of all, David Stern was pretty clear when they approved the Sonics' move to Oklahoma City. He was pretty clear that he thought that Seattle was an NBA-level market, and that if Seattle did come up with a better arena situation than Key Arena, that he would support a team moving. So I think that the ownership will be fall in line on this. I don't see any reason why they wouldn't. The issue is whether again Mr. Johnson can magically turn up some viable new owners who commit to a new stadium. I don't think that will happen. And then beyond that, the issue will be what the relocation fee is that will be charged to Mr. Hansen.
What have other people paid for relocation fees? Do you have any numbers on that?
They tend to be in the neighborhood of $20, $30, $40 million. In the NFL, sometimes the relocation fees are higher, but the franchises are worth a lot more. It really depends on what market you're leaving and what market you're going to.
And the NBA gets that money.
The NBA and the owners of the NBA would get that money, yes.
Huh. Oh, so it's spread out among all the owners of the NBA, inside the NBA?
Yes.
Sounds like a good deal, moving teams around.
Well, I guess that's right. And, you know, if you, it's also in other teams' interest to get teams into the best markets possible. Because if you take a team from a weak market where they're getting revenue sharing and you put them in a stronger market, then you don't have to share your revenue with them anymore.
I see. Was Sacramento getting some revenue sharing? Was it a weaker team in that sense?
I believe it was, yes. It was in a weaker market.
You know, there some people are talking politics here in terms of roadblocks, the political roadblock. The California Senate President Pro Tem Daryl Sternberg, he issued a he's making issue of Steve Ballmer's role in the deal, and he wrote two things. He said, I'm troubled at a company and a CEO that has for so long enjoyed a prosperous and beneficial working relationship with the state of California and its taxpayers would blatantly engage in activities which are clearly and measurably detrimental to our state's job and revenue base. And then he asked, how many technology contracts and at what total cost to the state does Microsoft Corporation currently have with the state of California? So he's rattling some cages and waving some flags. Any political power behind that? Have you seen any politicians make waves in other deals?
Politicians, I think, are wont to make waves all the time and to posture. I don't think that this will amount to very much. I mean, look, you with Microsoft or any other company, you always have issues about in professional sports that the people buying a franchise are very wealthy people, that they have homes in different states, that they do business in different states. But the fact of the matter is that no matter who you are, you want to make a deal that works. And you know whether Mr. Ballmer is a multimillionaire or billionaire or not, it doesn't have much bearing on what kind of a new investment he's going to make in a franchise. If he invests in a new company, he wants that company to be profitable. He doesn't take a point of view, and nor does any other investor take the point of view as, oh, I've made so much money in the past, I'm going to lose money on my next venture. The way these guys got rich is by being careful each time they spend money.
That's Andrew Zimbalist. He's a sports economist, a professor at Smith College. Looks like the Seattle Supersonics will be returning to Seattle. A deal was announced yesterday. We're going to take it up again. Stick around at 10:40 in our chat room. We're going to talk to a few folks, including the fellow who runs SonicsGate. What do you think about this deal, and what do you think about the move? A lot of hubbub. What are you thinking about Sonics coming back? Email me, weekday@kuow.org. I'd like to share some of your emails at 10:40 in our chat room.
In other sports-related news, Steve Kelly is leaving his job as a sports columnist for the Seattle Times after 30 years. He'll tell us why today at noon. It's 31 degrees in Seattle with clouds and fog. We're expecting the clouds to stick around. The fog should sort of start going away around noon or so. And we expect to hit a high today of 38.
Support for KUOW comes from Riddell Williams, for over a century providing legal representation and strategic thinking to achieve business objectives. More information on attorneys, experience, and practice areas at Riddell, R-I-D-D-E-L-L, Williams.com.
Today is Election Day in Israel, and it was a contentious campaign there. This afternoon, we're going to meet an Israeli singer-songwriter who explores his country's politics through his music. He's going to tell us how he tries to reach Israel's neighbors through song. That's today at 1:40 on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. It's 9:19. I'm Bernard Ouellette. The week's extended weather forecast and a hike to match that forecast in 35 minutes.
A hike or maybe a snowshoe. He's going to surprise us this morning. A snowy hike. All right. Some big questions about violence now and how we are contending with it. We humans. Contend with it, resort to it. We're going to take that up. The three interfaith amigos have been dropping by and talking to Katie Sewell about some of the big issues where religion can offer some thoughts, perhaps. Imam Jamal Rahman is co-founder and Muslim Sufi minister at Interfaith Community Sanctuary. He also teaches at Seattle University. Rabbi Ted Falcon is a teacher of Jewish meditation and spirituality. Pastor Don McKenzie is a former minister and head of staff at the University Congregational United Church of Christ. And they came in, Katie Sewell, to talk to you about this big question. Why do humans resort to violence?
Rabbi Ted Falcon told me that he found the issue of human violence to be very interesting from a spiritual point of view. So I asked him to explain what that interest is.
When we're talking about the limiting guns and automatic weapons, the limitation and regulation that needs to happen, it really begs the issue. It's a symptom. Like the use of the weapons are symptomatic of something bigger that's going on in the human condition. And we live in a kind of culture which pits us one against the other, where you win and you lose. It's not a system which promotes mutual support. On a spiritual level, spirituality is by definition inclusive. Where spiritual traditions get into trouble is where they forget that, and they think this spiritual tradition is right and the others are wrong. And it's opposite that. It's like the person who awakens with the greatest degree of spirituality is the most loving and the most caring. And would that kind of spirituality promote kindness in the world? So in that way, violent action is the antithesis of spiritual action in the world, and it speaks a level of unconsciousness. It speaks a level of forgetting the deeper nature of our being, forgetting the dignity of another human being, and buying into the more limited identity of separate selves fighting each other for a piece of a limited pie. And as long as we look at the world that way, whether it's with guns or with other weapons, we are going to be expressing violence.
Don, did you want to add something?
Well, we were at the rally, which had two aims. One was to ban assault weapons, and the other was to promote background checks.
And this is the rally that happened where?
At Seattle Center. Okay. There was a march from Westlake to Seattle Center. Mm-hmm. And we spoke briefly, each of us. And afterwards, we had an opportunity to speak with a person who was there promoting guns. It was against what was going on. Very civil person, very polite, had a pistol on a holster on his side. And one of the questions we said, why do you think people should be allowed to have assault weapons? And basically the answer was a fear of the government, certainly a deep distrust, which, again, I think is a symptom of this thing that Ted just described, that it's more than just we, they, us against them. I'm on my own. I've got to do everything I can to protect myself. We hear those things. We honor them, but we see them as particular instances of that larger lack of an awareness that we're here to help each other rather than hurt each other.
Jamal?
You know, many of the safeguards people are asking for, really demanding, they're really common sense demands. But of course, common sense is very uncommon. But beyond that, what my brothers have been discussing, I think this is really basically a spiritual issue. In Islamic spirituality, it is said that the human being is essentially very good, very noble. Every tradition says God is outside of you, also inside of you. But we have to awaken to that. And I love to say what the Quran says. The Quran says, besides God being in your heart, out of a spiritual design for divine purpose, God has also placed a slinking whisperer inside the heart. So there's a tension. There's a tendency towards wrongdoing unless we cultivate the spiritual practices of awareness, of compassion, of community. That takes a lot of effort. We don't do that work. If you don't do this work, the Quran says you can sink to the lowest of the low. That's one point. Second point is, I might be living in an environment where there's a lot of hopelessness, helplessness, chronic anger, chronic fear. Middle East, Afghanistan. The Quran says when there is this kind of chronic anger and fear, then it's not that the eyes become blind, the hearts become blind. When the hearts become blind, good people, we all consider ourselves good people do things that are not good because their hearts have become blinded. They commit acts of violence.
I'm speaking with the three interfaith amigos, Imam Jamal Rahman, just there speaking, Rabbi Ted Falcon and Pastor Don McKenzie, talking about the issue of violence from a spiritual perspective. And one thing I wanted to bring up is that human violence is a very prevalent theme in a lot of scriptural texts and stories. Why do you think that is?
The Bible has all kinds of violent episodes. Also has all kinds of loving episodes. It's very much a reflection of who we are and an attempt to talk about how we're growing. I'm not always sure we're doing so well growing. The rabbinic metaphor is that within every person there is a yetzer hara, an inclination to self-indulgence, an inclination to self-aggrandizement. Often called the evil impulse, but what it is putting oneself ahead of everybody else. I want mine, let everybody else take care of theirs. And within every person is a Yetzer HaTov, or the Yetzer Tov, the inclination for good. And whatever you call it, we see that in stories of every tradition. And what we're seeing is, how do we deal with those urges toward helping ourselves at the expense of others versus supporting community and supporting acts of loving kindness in the world? And it's an ongoing pursuit. Sometimes looking at things, it appears we haven't learned very much. But what we're now confronted with is a kind of world in which we better learn quickly, or else we have the capacity of destroying ourselves.
And what do you make of the acts of violence that are portrayed as being divinely inspired?
I don't have a belief in a God who commands violent behavior. I think we tend to perceive God depending on the place of consciousness from which we are viewing the divine. When I'm in an ego place, or when my people were in an ego place, the projection is God as a big ego. What does an ego do? An ego rewards and punishes. An ego sets rules. An ego tells you what you should do. An ego strives to have the power. And so that's projected outward as if that's God. But all our traditions agree that God is bigger than that. God is not simply a projection of an ego. God is not simply an ego. God is a universal presence. God is a universal being that contains all of us, that contains everything. So essentially what we're looking at is the quest for the deeper awakening of the reality of oneness.
What do you want to add, Don?
Well, I think of course, I like what Ted said, of course. But
well, you better. I mean, we're sitting too close to each other
now. I think we've said to each other many times, the Bible contains passages that reflect that ego description that Ted did so well. And it also contains passages that reflect a more of an open-hearted, compassionate sensibility. And one of the challenges for a person of faith, no matter what the tradition, is to learn over time to differentiate between passages that are ego-centered and passages that really contribute to the healing that religion really is here to help with, even though it can be compromised by other things. In the case of the New Testament, there aren't a whole lot of violent passages, but certainly Jesus observes things about violence. I mean, Jesus was the one who said, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. He didn't mean love like Valentine's Day. He meant evolving into that sensibility that Rabbi Ted described, which is also in the Quran, to that place where you can see another person and love that person without conditions. It doesn't mean you're not critical or anything like that. But in the context of this very important fact, because of the oneness, that we are really here to help each other and not hurt each other.
Jamal?
You know, it's also very fascinating that in each of our traditions, in the Quran we say people of the book, there are some verses that are just I think Don would say stunning. For example, the Quran says, repel evil with something which is better, so that your enemy becomes your intimate friend. So it's almost like God has such faith in humanity that they are capable of attaining this extraordinary state of consciousness. Well, they will really strive. The word in the Quran is jihad. The jihad is a very misunderstood word. It just means effort. They will make that jihad, that effort, to turn an enemy into an intimate friend. But this work of jihad, effort, really is what we call the inconvenient work. It's really what the Quran says for the Muslim, you have three stages of the ego. And it is your work to transform those stages of the ego. The first stage is where the ego is a commanding master. It wants to rule over you. You must, through your cultivation of awareness, compassion, love, community, master that. You move on the next stage, then the third stage. And the third stage is when your ego personality is aligned with your higher self. That's what Islam means. And that requires, and that is the real meaning of jihad. It's fascinating that also that Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, when he came back from a battle, he said, we have come back from the lesser jihad, the effort to defend ourselves when attacked. Let's now do the greater jihad, which is the inner effort of transforming the ego. That is the most essential but inconvenient work of becoming a better human being, and that is the main message of each of our traditions.
Often we're asked, is the function of religion or the function of spirituality to rid human beings of conflict? We say, no, conflict is going to always be part of the human condition. The goal is to be able to express that conflict in nonviolent terms, you know, rather than being overwhelmed by it through fear of another, through antagonism to another, through dehumanization of another, through demonization of another, where we are willing to harm another and kill another, rather than looking at our conflicts and addressing them in ways that can be supportive and helpful.
Well, from the perspective that you're at, do you see this being a time when that's happening, or because of the mass media and us being able to silo our views so easily on the internet, are we working in the opposite direction?
You know, Jamal and Don and I rarely have fistfights anymore.
But we have vigorous discussions.
Yes. But you three have made the effort to come together and discuss, and not everybody is making that effort. So how do we move forward as a society?
One of the ways is for those of us who are focused on that as an agenda, not to polarize against those who are not. Pastor Don mentioned the gun rally, and there's a tendency in that to go, okay, we're on this side, those people are on the other side. How can we understand conflict, wherever it is, whether it's Israel-Palestine, whether it's weapons enthusiasts and those who want to decrease weapons, the violence caused by weapons? How do we create the context in which we can embrace both and seek to understand more fully where the other person is standing? That's like asking the guy with the pistol, you know, why do they need a gun? And then one would have to go further and go, what evidence have you ever had that the government is going to start shooting at your house?
That was really a moving moment, actually. I mean, we were walking away. It was at the end, and they stopped us politely and wanted to ask us something and really wanted us to hear them. And I think that's certainly legitimate. They were very civil about it. As we were standing there, I thought if we had the opportunity to sit down with them and get behind the particulars we were arguing about and really get to know them, what's the story behind the passion that they have for their point of view? That's what we say about interfaith dialogue. You know, mm-hmm. You can't argue about particulars without really having gotten to know the other. And then once you have that level of understanding and trust, you can start to compare things and the particulars and so forth. But it's that ability and willingness and even taking the time to get to know the other that is so necessary right now, especially in our polarized world.
I think that is the key. How can we create in a sincere, humble way the environment where we can truly get to know the other on a human, personal level? We've been saying it again and again, but I think we are a good model having done that and continue to do that. Something else I want to add, what I noticed yesterday talking to that young man, here was a great opportunity to establish a personal relationship. But he was saying, and his idea was, there are some evil people out there, and the good people need to have the guns to protect themselves against the evil people and, you know, in a sense, do away with them. And I was thinking very strongly about that one quote we always mention by Alexander Solzhenitsyn, that great Russian dissident, who so appropriately said, if only it was so simple, that there are some evil people out there, and all you have to do is to isolate them, separate them, and destroy them. He says, alas, the line dividing good and evil runs through every single human heart. And who is willing to tear a piece of his or her own heart? I think if we were able to create the context of friendship, of a sincere desire to connect without any agenda, we'd have made more headway with that gentleman.
Imam Jamal Rahman is co-founder and Muslim Sufi minister at the Interfaith Community Sanctuary and adjunct faculty at Seattle University. Rabbi Ted Falcon is a teacher of Jewish meditation and spirituality. He is the founder of Makom Or Shalom, a synagogue in Los Angeles, and Beit Alif, meditative synagogue in Seattle. And Pastor Don McKenzie is the former minister and head of staff at University Congregational United Church of Christ in Seattle. Together, they're the Interfaith Amigos. Thanks again for coming in, you guys.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is Weekday.
The Interfaith Amigos talking with KUOW's Katie Sewell. Now, who's more dangerous, a person who shares violent thoughts and confidentiality, or a person who keeps such thoughts to themselves? A conversation about how gun laws relate to counseling and confidentiality with Joe Guppy, a practicing psychotherapist, in a minute. Right here on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from STG, presenting Hedvig and the Angry Inch, a co-production with Balogun Theater, starring Jarek Hoffer, live at the Moore Theater, now through January 27th. Tickets available at stgpresents.org.
31 degrees in Seattle, with a predicted high today of 38. We've got clouds and fog right now, expecting clouds through the day. Heavy fog through the morning should start breaking up around midday. We might get a couple of sun breaks this afternoon. Then overnight, it's cloudy with a chance of rain and a low of 37. Tomorrow, Wednesday, rain expected with a high of 44.
Support for KUOW comes from Little Brown & Company, publishers of Maria Semple's Where'd You Go, Bernadette?, a novel about parenting, privilege, and life in Seattle.
It's 9:38. I'm Bernard Ouellette. Should the state of Washington end its Guaranteed Education Tuition, or GET, program? Some state lawmakers say yes. We'll find out who wants the state to get out of the prepaid tuition business and why in about a half an hour.
But first, more about violence and individuals. You're listening to Weekday. I'm Steve Scheer. Well, what is more dangerous? Who is more dangerous? A person who shares violent thoughts and confidentiality, or a person who keeps those thoughts to themselves? Joe Guppy was thinking about this. He's a Seattle psychotherapist in private practice. His specialties include anger management issues, addictions, and relationship issues. Good to see you.
Nice to be here, Steve.
Should we? Guppy is a well-known name in this town. Do you have any relations to the other Guppies?
I do. I'm married to Nancy Guppy, and I'm the brother of Paul Guppy.
Well, we could have a whole panel, just you and Paul Guppy and Nancy Guppy. That would be interesting.
That would be fun.
So you were thinking about this in part because of what's been happening in the news.
Yes. I was kind of shocked when I read this New York Times article that the New York state legislature had changed the laws regarding confidentiality and therapists when therapists break confidentiality. I mean, I'm sure you can imagine that therapy rests on this idea of privacy and confidentiality, right? We go in there to talk about our most personal stuff. And so if a therapist breaks confidentiality, that's a big deal.
What was the change in the law?
Well, the current law or the current guidelines that we operate here in Washington State and as far as I know in every other state in the country is that if a client makes a serious threat to harm themselves or to harm another person, then the therapist is required to intervene in a situation like that. It comes out of a California Supreme Court ruling in the 1970s. Now, the new language, and I'll read right from the New York Times article, it says, the New York statute requires doctors and other mental health professionals to report any person who is, quote, likely to engage in conduct that would result in serious harm to self or others. So there's a key shift there from the focus on what the client says, whether the client's making a threat or not, to what the therapist believes.
Interpretation.
Yeah, the therapist's speculations. I've often said that therapists, we're not fortune tellers, we're not mind readers, we can't predict the future any better than anybody else. And I think people wish that we could, but the fact is we don't have any greater powers of clairvoyance than the average person.
All right, so a little more about this. What is it called, Tarasoff?
Yeah, that's the...
Duty to warn.
That's duty to warn. That is the Supreme Court, California State Supreme Court ruling that I was talking about. It was a tragic case. A client was told his psychiatrist, confessed to a psychiatrist that he was considering or seriously thinking about murdering this woman he had dated. And obviously he was very angry and resentful and such. Now, the therapist didn't just ignore it or blow it off. The therapist did work with the client in many ways for a number of months, but did not warn the intended victim that this threat was present. And so the Supreme Court ruled that he was negligent not to do that. So that became the standard. It's the same standard for harm to self or harm to others. Is there an imminent threat? Does it look like this? Is this person saying things that indicate that they're likely to offend?
What's the therapist's responsibility, to warn the individual or to warn authorities?
Either one, or both. They have to take action. What I say to my clients, and see, the important thing to remember is that we have this conversation at the beginning, well, the first time we meet a client. We have a discussion about the limits of confidentiality. For example, child abuse. Most people know you need to call Child Protective Services if you find out about that. Same thing, if we're moving in the direction of an imminent danger to self or others, the therapist is required to intervene, and that can mean warning the intended victim in that case, a hospitalization, calling the police, whatever it required. It's kind of a common sense thing to save lives. And clients always react when I say that. They nod their heads and they go, yeah, that makes sense. And if they are thinking of self-harm or harm to another person, I think it's actually a positive feeling. They go, oh, there's a limit here. There's a common sense limit here. The therapist, if you will, you know, is going to stop me if I take these thoughts or ideas I may have too far.
So a positive rather than it being, well, I'm not going to talk if I have to. I will guard my speech,
right,
even with this therapist.
I think if I were to come out with an extremely vague statement like, I'm supposed to decide whether you're likely to engage in conduct or not, based on what criteria? Maybe what you said, maybe something else, who knows what. It's so vague that it sets up this adversarial relationship, and rather than forming a therapeutic alliance with the best part of the client, which came up in the last discussion.
Yeah.
I found that very interesting, that whole question about what we have inside ourselves and our inner conflicts between good and evil. Well, the therapist wants to make an alliance with the positive, good part of the person who doesn't want to act out in this way. Now, if I'm perceived as a representative of the government, the investigator, the judge, right from the very start, how much disclosure do you think I'm going to get? And beyond that, how many people are not even going to show up in the counselor's office because the counselor is perceived as this judge or this policeman?
Joe Guppy is a counselor, a Seattle psychotherapist in private practice. Well, and yet we want society to be protected. What's the how do you go about then sort of laying down, once you've made those initial markers, you're trying to make the arrangement, the relationship with the positive side. How do you draw out enough knowledge? How do you draw out from the client the information you need to understand about their interests, their concerns, and their potential dangers? I guess that's the job.
Right, and it's a very difficult job, but it's all about building a trusting relationship with the person. And So let me give you an example here. This is an analogy. It's not a perfect analogy, but I think it helps clarify this because it takes out of this extremely hot button issue. So let's just say now one of the areas I work in is relationships, sexuality, sexual addiction. So let's imagine I have a male client, and the client tells me that they're having thoughts in their head about having an affair. Now, what doesn't it? I would say it decreases the chances they will actually act on those thoughts if they bring that out into the open. If we discuss it, we may talk about their values. We may have them understand. Oh, you can have a feeling, you can have a desire, whether it's an angry feeling or a sexual feeling, but you are not compelled to act on it. That's one of the things that people learn in interaction with other human beings. Now, supposing we had a Taliban-style government that said, well, any therapist who hears about a possibility of infidelity, the thought of infidelity from one of their clients, they need to report that to the government. What would happen to client disclosure? I think that it would dry up.
You think it would affect the rates of actual infidelity?
Yes.
Might go up?
I would ask the listener out there, what do you think would happen if people were keeping their disturbed thinking entirely inside their own head, not feeling safe to bring it out to another human being? What's the more likely result?
So you led a youth anger management group for a long time?
I did, yeah, in Shoreline.
What were you trying to do with the young people who came to the management group?
Well, really trying to draw them out into interactions with each other and in interactions with me to have them discover their own angry feelings and bring it out into the open. I would ask them to tell stories. Tell me the story of when you got into trouble. We would take the story and lay it out on the whiteboard, and people would. Other group members would suggest alternative choices at certain choice points in the story. My observation about people that are disturbed, in this case we'll talk about anger, is that there's a lot of chaos inside the mind. The thoughts are not very well organized. The story is not well organized. And it was wonderful to see these kids get these stories out onto the whiteboard and then give each other feedback. And that's the thing. I would say multiple minds are saner than the single mind.
Did it work? Did you over time see a change in people's ability to process their anger and work through it?
Yeah, I would say that it was successful. I mean, we didn't have the money to do a real scientific tracking study or something like that. But I remember some really key moments in the group where one time I sort of there was sort of a face-off between me and a young client. It was not violent in any way, but it was sort of a man-to-man moment where he directed some of his anger at me, and I put up a boundary, and I think that was a key turning point for this young man. And again, my point is it came in the context of an authentic relationship because, Steve, you know, the number one effective treatment is the therapeutic relationship between the client and the therapist. Study after study has shown this. People have tried to prove that an individual a given technique is most effective. It always comes down to the authentic relationship between the therapist and the client. That's what's effective.
So what about the people that aren't coming to you? How do you reach them but need to?
Yeah, I'm not sure I have an answer for that one, other than the fact that I think these new laws by far keep people out of counseling. Now, I guess I could say in general, I'm in private practice, but in general, I'd like to see more funding going toward the mental health system. It's ironic that I think that this new standard would overburden. I heard a story on KUOW a while back that there aren't enough beds at Harborview, there aren't enough beds in Western State to already there aren't enough beds to assess the people that are considered dangerous. Now, this law would double, triple, I don't even know, quadruple the number of people that are being referred to assessment, people that really are, I believe, would be of no danger to themselves or others.
By the way, that's a New York State law. Is there any indication that Washington State legislators are looking at the same thing?
I have heard no indication of that, but I'll tell you, I sent out an email to colleagues telling them I'm going to be on the air. I'm getting emails back saying, please don't let this happen here. You go.
You go.
Yeah.
You talked to some of those young people in that anger management group about guns and whether they bring guns to school, whether they draw pictures of guns. What do they say to you about the gun in their life?
Well, in that particular case, there were not youth that were dealing with guns. In that group, it never came up that the youth themselves had guns. So I can talk about that with regard to some other clients.
But for young people, you just talk to them about it. You never had an issue with
it. We never had an issue in that particular group.
How do you talk to older people then about violence and their guns?
Well, it's a very delicate topic. That's the one thing I learned. It often takes months of work with somebody before they'll come forward and talk about what kind of firepower they have. And there's only been a couple of instances where I've found out that people had some serious weaponry. In each case, I did the assessment of violent ideation, and it turned out they were safe. But they're very wary to disclose in the first place because of the. I think these new laws kind of stoke the paranoia because they're leading the therapist to be seen as the person who's investigating whether they have guns or not. This new law would have
in
New York State. The new law in New York State would have people would have the therapist would have the police come in and take away the weapons if the therapist reported these things.
Well, that's very interesting because you know what most people talk about when they want to see increased focus on mental health. They talk about reducing the stigma. Mm-hmm. Reduce the stigma.
Right.
It should be a part of our health care system that we all deal with our mental health.
Right.
It's very interesting that the people who own guns are worried about the stigma attached to being a gun owner.
Mm-hmm.
and how polarized that has become.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Where do you so you don't want this law to change. You want the confidentiality to remain sort of a little more concrete mm-hmm. in the assessment. But how do we reduce the stigma? And not just for the people who need mental health, but for the people who own guns. In your own practice itself, what kind of conversations do you have with those folks about their guns?
One thing I'd like to normalize is and this kind of goes back to what the three amigos were talking about just before I came on, is to normalize the fact that we're all in inner conflict. We all have inner dialogue. Not to say that everyone's crazy. I sometimes joke with clients. I say I'm not trying to suggest that we all have multiple personality disorder or we all hear voices in our heads. But the truth is we do kind of have voices in our heads that discuss things with each other. And in a way, maybe I just kind of say this in sort of a joking way, but I think we all ought to admit how crazy we all are in that sense. If that's the measurement of crazy, I don't think it is. Because we're all doing it. We're all in an inner dialogue, inner conflict all the time. Can we listen inside our own? I'm a great proponent of awareness meditation, which allows us to listen to our own thinking. It's a great way to work with people that are angry, with people with addictions, because you start to become more aware of that discussion that's going on in your head. And so I think that takes away the stigma. If we talk more openly about the way, quote, we're all crazy in certain ways, and that we need each other and we need this open flow of relationship amongst the community that where we reveal the way what we're really thinking about. And it's not the end of the world if you reveal that you have an angry thought or that you have a sexually inappropriate thought or something like that.
Boy, talk about the stigma attached to that for normal people to do the kind of whiteboard working out of ideas and conflicts that you're talking about. That'd be a profound shift, wouldn't it?
Yeah, because we're always guarding each other. We're always guarding ourselves. We call it impression management. You know, like for example, I would say that you and I have a contract between each other right now that we're not going to attack each other. We're not thinking about that. It's just something a contract that we made subconsciously as soon as we walked into the room.
Yep.
I am not going to jump across the table and strangle you. Okay. But see, it's interesting, my background in comedy, I will bring forth sort of comedic or exaggerated examples as a way of acknowledging this kind of thing. Nancy and I do that ourselves often. We're very open about, well, Nancy's my wife, by the way, and we have a terrific marriage, but one of the things we'll do is joke about how...
Just be clear.
yeah. We'll joke about how angry we might feel. And I would say because we're so open about that kind of those kind of thoughts, we feel extremely safe around each other.
More therapy and more comedy, Joe Guppy. I think that's my conclusion from this as well. Joe Guppy is a Seattle psychotherapist in private practice, thinking about confidentiality, violence, and how to be clearer with each other in our society. That was good.
And,
thank you.
And how we can be safe.
And how we can be safe.
Yeah.
That's good. Thank you.
Thank you.
And now, the sound of the day.
That's the sound of 30 cats clamoring for breakfast. 30 cats sent to us by Maddie, who works at a cat hotel called All My Kitties. Very nice. In Seattle. Really, Maddie, a cat hotel? We want to know more about that. She says the sound in person is really quite alarming, but it only happens when she's carrying the food tray. Cat hotel called All My Kitties. Yes, Maddie, we want to know more about this. And what about you? What are your interesting sounds and how is it affecting your life? How alarming are they? Record 30 seconds of it. Send it to us with sound of the day in the subject line. We want to hear what your day sounds like. Pretty interesting. Michael Fagan's day is going to sound like, apparently the pitter-patter of little rain. Michael Fagan is with West Coast Weather LLC. He blogs and writes about weather and hike at hikewashington.net. Hello, Michael.
Hi, Steve. How are you doing?
I'm very good. So, first of all, the weather forecast, we're looking at some changes, yes?
That's right. I know a lot of people have been complaining about being in the split pea fog episodes lately, and things will be clearing out on Wednesday as the weather system moves in. It'll be our first rain, actually, since January 10th, so... we're due for some rain and due for some mountain snow, so chance of some light rain on Wednesday, and the main message will clear the fog out and bring some new mountain snow, so skiers will be happy, and then rain on and off Thursday through the weekend, so back to a more normal basis. We have two trips for this week. Both are at Mount Rainier National Park. The first one is the Wonderland Trail from Longmire towards Cougar Rock. Now, I didn't hear any cats on this hike. It was pretty mellow hike. It's a snowshoe trip. This is a short one, 2 miles one way, minimal elevation gain. You don't get any grand views of the mountain, but you get a view of the forest, a view of the Nisqually River, and then when you're done with your snowshoe trip, you go back to Longmire and have a hot drink or meal at the lodge. The second trip is a snowshoe, and if you're a real good skier, you ski to Reflection Lakes. There's several ways to get there, but the one I did last week was at Jackson Visitor Center, and you need to make a note. It's not open Tuesday or Wednesday, but all other days. It's you get up to the road after 9 when it usually opens.
Oh, good. All right.
I did put a map on there. Make sure you take the avalanche safe route because there's some potential avalanche issues. But again, I put a map out there so you can. Check that out on my blog. It's not a lot of miles. This is 2 miles one way. There are lots of ups and downs, so you get a good workout, about 1,500-foot elevation gain. And I want to give a shout-out to the Washington Ski Touring Club. They do ski patrol over the weekend, so if you have questions, you could ask them. They put signs and trail maps out there, so that's real handy. And then when you're done with the trip, you go to the Jackson Visitor Center. It has heated restrooms, which will be most welcome, and then during the weekends, it's open for food service.
Very nice.
And this is Green Trails Map 269S, and you need a National Park Forest Pass to get in.
I love the pictures you and Karen Sykes, I guess, took here. That's on hikewashington.net. There's some nice slopes that a person, easy slopes that a person could be enjoying on the way to Reflection Lakes.
Yeah, it's a wonderful trip. So, again, you can't get up there Tuesday or Wednesday, but if you do go out today or Wednesday, you could go to Longmire and do the snowshoe trip up towards Cougar Rock. So,
very nice.
Couple options, so enjoy.
Hey, how'd that contest work out?
It worked out well. It ended yesterday at midnight, and we got quite a few responses. It's for the strongest wind gust at SeaTac through the end of this month, and I haven't had a chance to look at the exact records yet. I believe we had a gust in about 42 miles per hour. So,
wow.
In fact, someone actually guessed 42 miles per hour. So if we don't get a stronger gust between now and the end of the month, they'll win. So we'll do another contest. I know it's been quite popular.
A lot of fun. All right, it's a couple of hikes to think about. HikeWashington.net. You can find out.
The best day weather-wise is today, so maybe you could rush out and maybe run up to Tiger Mountain if you want to do something local.
Oh, that sounds very good right now. There's even a little bit of fog and sun. I see some shadows on people so in Red Square, so maybe there's a little bit of sun burning through.
Yeah, you go up to Tiger and get above the fog layer.
All right, Michael, good to talk to you.
Same here.
I'm inspired. We'll talk next week. More weekday ahead. We're in the chat room and much more. Stick around.
The inaugural festivities are over. And
thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.